original and natural tastes. We use spices as much as necessary in food. Each culinary school has prominent aroma and flavor that is introduced with it. The fragrance of Iranian cuisine is made of saffron, cardamom, and rose water and a golden color. Iranian food has a mild taste. In cooking, we pay attention to the benefits and what is harmful in the ingredients. Everything must be in balance. Kermanshah pure animal oil, ambarbu, tarimi and hashimi rice, lamb of Mughan, afshar and sangsari, Azerbaijan yogurt, desful citrus, dates of bam and bushir, Khorasan wheat, and north and south fish each have a special and unique taste. This documentary is a tribute to thousands of years of Iranian cooking. This work is about Iranian food. It is about people we don't know but who are involved in our sustenance. This documentary is a tribute to the mothers of this land who taught their children the cooking traditions of Iran generation after generation so that this old and unique art remains eternal. This documentary is a tribute to our beloved country, Iran. Iran is a country full of wealth in so many ways, tens of generations before us, and we use the same Iranian dishes, and it is up to us to protect the sacred heritage. I'm Nusha Tabibi Gilani. I'm interested in Iranian culture and food. After the invasion of Mahmud Hotak and the destruction of the Safavid dynasty, and a turbulent period was imposed on Iran. The conflicts and rise of Nadir Shah and then the rule of Karim Khan Zand brought short periods of balance and peace that were not very stable. In these periods, naturally, decorative arts and the construction of buildings and emirates were not considered and did not have a chance to grow. Agha Mohammad Khan, the ruler of the Qajar dynasty, established a new era for Iran by unifying the country and establishing regulations, stability, and security. In this period, the construction of buildings, state emirates, and decorative arts started again. Qajari special aesthetics gradually appeared. There is a mixture of delicate and detailed Safavid art and European-style paintings. The use of new colors and patterns signaled the beginning of another era in Iranian fine arts. Gulistan Palace in Tehran is a perfect example of Qajar art. Its foundation was laid during the Safavid rule and reached perfection and beauty during the time of the Qajar rulers. We can see a collection of carved tiles, statues, marble thrones, perforated windows, delicate sash windows with colorful glasses, and detailed mirror work. There are rooms that are covered from half of the walls to the ceiling with paintings of faces of the mythological and historical kings of Iran, flowers, birds, arabesque and toranche patterns. There are also beautiful nastaliq scripts in this place. The Qajarite seems a little rougher compared to what was left from the Safavid period. Among the kings of Qajar, Nasiruddin Shah had an artistic vision. Of course, in cooking and food, a special style of his period has remained. One of the royal ceremonies was Ashpazan. This ceremony was held in full detail every year. Its central core was cooking, which originated from Nasiruddin Shah's personal interests in it. The cooking of Nazri Ash was founded for the health of the king by his mother, Malik Jahan Khanum, and according to another story, Amina Akhdas, his wife. Dr. Jean-Baptiste Fevreur also believes that this type of ash was vowed by the king in the year of the outbreak of cholera to protect himself from the disease. This ceremony was held in the early autumn when all the men, nobles, and lords gathered in Surkh-e-Hisar. The sofre was spread under the tents, and the nobles of the country used to sit on the ground and clean vegetables and peel eggplants. They used all kinds of vegetables and summer fruits, dried and fresh fruits, nuts, melons, sugar, turmeric, saffron, rice, wheat, lamb, and poultry in this ash. There were 30 huge cauldrons on fire pits. When ash was prepared, women would come out and Anis Adul poured the first bowl of ash for Nasiruddin Shah with a golden ladle, and then others would start eating. This custom was maintained until the end of Nasiruddin Shah's reign, and then it was abolished. Iranians have the same skill in cooking various types of bread as they have a unique skill in cooking different types of ash. Bread and ash are predominant in Iranian cooking and play important roles in our cuisine. Cooking each of these important elements in Iranian sofre needs different skills. Many hidden treasures of the Iranian culture and history can be found in Khorasan.
روستای ترخ در نزدیکی کاشمر کاشمر رو در قدیم
ترک ویلیج از لوکیتد نیر کاشمر اند هاز ا ریچ هیستری ان مای اپینین اف سمون وانتس تو نو ایران هی ماست نو خراسان The Farsi language we speak today is the same that has spread throughout Iran from this region. The Farsi language we speak today is the same and it has spread throughout Iran from this region. I think that Khorasan still retains many of its historical features. When we look for Iranian roots, we can find many of them in Khorasan even today. Tark village is located near Kashmir and still sticks to its old texture and is full of life. There are kind and generous people in this region. They are very hospitable, and we have been staying here for a while. We got familiar with the people, their customs and traditions. We found traces of these traditions in the rich history of our land. There are different kinds of bread made of the famous Khorasan wheat, daim, which is known as red wheat. Good quality bread is prepared from this type of wheat. There are also different types of ash. According to many researchers, ashreshte basically comes from Khorasan. They cook a special kind of ashreshte in this village. In this dish, instead of using the usual vegetables that we use in other cities of our country, they use a special vegetable called kurya. They harvest this kind of vegetable from the hills around this same village. When this vegetable is dried, it is called black grass or black leaf. This vegetable is very tasty and wonderful and gives a special taste to this type of ashreshte.
و وقتی که این رو میپزن یا خشک میشه بهش میگن علف سیاه یا برگ سیاه خیلی سبزی خوش طعم فوق العاده ای و طعم ویژه ای به آش رشته مخصوص روستای ترق میده.
Chorba is cooked and eaten in neighboring countries. As its name suggests, it has Iranian roots. Ba means ash in Farsi, and there are different types of that like sirkeba or sekba or chorba that are recorded in history. This is an old Iranian tradition based on which family members gathered around a sofre, which was full of love. They would eat bread and ash and were thankful for Allah's blessings. They believed that the presence of guests around such sofre would increase their blessings. The Iranian sofre has been formed in full compliance with the special climate of this land. Water wasn't available and cultivation was impossible before. They had to take water from far away to the agricultural lands or to the homes. Therefore, the collective intelligence of Iranians has formed a special school of cooking based on the mentioned conditions. This type of cooking has an amazing and unique variety despite the many natural limitations. Iranians also paid attention to other matters such as architecture and urban engineering. They considered the details and adaptability of these buildings according to nature and the climate. Jami Mosque of Gonabad is an example of artistry, elegance, and harmony with nature and climate. This mosque has two porches, which is known as the Khorasani style mosque. Various types of Khorasani ash are unique, just like Khorasani architecture. Among these different kinds of ash, ashjush pare has a distinct appearance and also tastes wonderful. Ashjush pare had different appearances according to recipes written in Safavid cookbook. They put ingredients of ashjush pare in dumpling wrappers and then cook them. Then they add kashk, roasted poppy, and mint fried in oil. When a person eats ashjush pare, he experiences delicious flavors. They use a combination of beans, lentils, spices, and vegetables in this type of ash. This extremely delicious dish does not contain meat. Eshkene is the most important type of Iranian food apart from ash. The history of this dish goes back to the ancient past. It is a simple and accessible food that can be prepared from very simple ingredients. One could satiate his hunger by eating eshkene. It also optimizes people's energy. Iranians used this food a lot until a few decades ago, but today they rarely eat eshkene. The people of every corner of Iran prepared eshkene using available ingredients in their regions. One can prepare eshkene with a handful of flour and available fragrant vegetables and add pieces of bread. Using bread makes it a filling dish. Farmers and workers used to eat eshkene. Today we could say that ash and aplusht derive from eshkene. They use chunky pieces of bread in tilit, ash, abgusht, and eshkene. A kind of taftan that is baked in some regions of Khorasan is completely different from the kinds of bread baked in Tehran and Isfahan. The size and thickness of this bread makes it filling for people who use it. There's a kind of eshkene that is made of yogurt. This dish is really famous in Khorasan. They serve it with roasted tomatoes and eggplants. The full plate of this meal eshkene comes with pieces of bread in it, roasted tomatoes, eggplants. This dish is healthy, simple, very delicious, and is made without meat. They make ash with flour or dough balls, wheat, barley, and rice. Noodles are sometimes main ingredients of some types of ash. Cutting noodles in Sultanye and Zanjan has a long history.
برخلاف ادعای بسیاری رشته قطعاً از اروپا به ایران نیامده بلکه
contrary to many claims, noodles definitely did not come to Iran from Europe. It was the other way around, and noodles went from the east to the west. In our ancient texts, we can see names of different types of noodles that people used, like bandeqaba, gisuye yar, pulati, among many others. It shows that we have a long history in using noodles. It is probably the case that we learned how to eat noodles from our eastern neighbors. Maybe we learned it from the Chinese.
شاید از چین در واقع به ایران آمده باشه. در این جایی که ما هستیم گزلدره
یک Now we are in Gozaldare, Sofla. We will visit a place where they cut noodles. We will know about the process of making noodles.
خواهیم دید
Cutting noodles is a very common job in Sultanya and Gozaldare Sofla. It means that there are several workshops and people eat different types of noodles. Sultanya was a center of the Ilkhanids government, and it may be the reason why so many people eat noodles in this area. Eating Chinese food was the Ilkhanids culture and can be the reason for the establishment of so many workshops here. These workshops are still active. Sultanya was a city that did not last many years. It suddenly appeared in history by the Ilkhanate kings, and it was destroyed after Muhammad Khodabandi's death. He left many important works in this area, like knife making in Zanjan, cutting noodles, and Dashkasan temple.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In the 2020 presidential election, former U.S. President Donald Trump was able to challenge President Joe Biden to a large extent in terms of economic indicators. In other words, the economy became the weak point of Biden and the Democrats. Now, there are signs that their continuation could make it difficult for Biden or any other Democratic Party candidate in the 2024 presidential election. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some world media for further details. Please stay with us to hear more about this story. The Financial Times reports the Federal Reserve warned that the latest banking turmoil could trigger a broad credit crunch that threatens to slow the U.S. economy, while central bank lenders said they plan to tighten lending standards amid concerns about loan losses and deposit flight. Two separate Fed releases on Monday, May 8, highlighted growing concerns that the collapses of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank in March and recent collapse of the First Republic will lead to a contraction in lending and push asset prices lower. The U.S. Federal Reserve said in its semi-annual financial stability report that despite decision action by regulators and officials to deal with recent regional banking crises, concerns about the economic outlook, credit quality, and funding liquidity could mean that banks and other financial institutions to further contract the supply of credit to the economy. The Fed added, a sharp decline in the availability of credit would raise the cost of financing for businesses and households, potentially leading to a slowdown in economic activity. The possibility of a credit crunch was cited as one of the top current risks to the financial system, rather than the Fed's most likely scenario. But it reflected concerns about the macroeconomic impact of one of the most turbulent months in American finance since 2008 global financial crisis. Fears of a credit crunch come as a potential U.S. debt default looms, while the White House and Congress are locked in an impasse over increasing the government's $31.4 trillion credit limit. As part of its stability report, the Fed surveyed market experts and academics. The stock, which ranks stress in the banking sector as top threat to stability, has quadrupled since the fall and is now on par with inflation and U.S.-China tensions. According to this survey, concerns about commercial and residential real estate are also increasing rapidly. The Fed also released the results of its quarterly opinion poll of senior loan officers on Monday, May 8, which showed banks expect to tighten lending standards for the remainder of 2023. Bank officials pointed to concerns about a recession and withdrawals from deposits following the collapse of the SVB. The Fed said in the survey, medium-sized compared to the largest banks with between $50 billion and $250 billion in assets and other banks more frequently cited concerns about their liquidity positions, deposit outflows, and funding costs as reasons for tightening. In order to retain depositors, some banks have had to offer higher yields on savings accounts, which weighed on profit margins. Mid-sized banks, which face the largest outflows of deposits, also fear tighter regulations and possible changes in accounting rules. Regarding how a possible credit crunch could spread more broadly, the Fed's financial stability report said there was a risk of falling profits and rising corporate defaults. It added, furthermore, a related reduction in investor risk appetite could lead to a significant fall in asset prices. The Fed also warned of weakness in the commercial real estate sector, saying the magnitude of a correction in real estate values could be significant and therefore lead to credit losses for CRE debt holders. The central bank said it will also monitor developments in commercial real estate loans more closely and expand screening procedures for banks with a greater focus on this sector. Meanwhile, Agence France-Presse writes, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned of an emerging financial catastrophe, once again raising the alarm about the failure of lawmakers to timely approve the rising of the government's monumental debt ceiling. Yellen said on Sunday, May 7th, Congress's failure to act upon the debt ceiling could trigger a constitutional crisis that also would call into question the federal government's creditworthiness, calling on lawmakers from both dominant political parties to make sure that Congress does its job and readily approves the U.S. government's budget bill. She underlined it's Congress' job to do this, reiterating if they fail to do it, we will have an economic and financial catastrophe that will be of our own making. And there is no action that President Joe Biden and the U.S. Treasury can take to prevent that catastrophe. Yellen further on the line, our priority is to make sure that Congress does its job. There is no way to protect our financial system in our economy other in Congress doing its job and raising the debt ceiling and enabling us to pay our bills. This would be a constitutional crisis. Yellen had previously stressed that it was the basic responsibility of Congress to increase or suspend the whopping $31.4 trillion borrowing cap set for the government without delay. After the January due date had expired, the U.S. Treasury chief told lawmakers in February that the government will likely run out of money in June and most likely be unable to issue payments to its employees, the military's family, seniors, and others dependent on the government. However, Republican lawmakers have linked an increase to the government's debt ceiling to its slashing of public spending. Republican House Majority Leader Steve Scalise of Louisiana insisted in a recent interview that passage of debt ceiling would require Biden and other Democrats to change the entire dynamic of the process, thus putting pressure on them to better engage in negotiations with Republican lawmakers.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
May 13, 1984. Place Husseiniya Jamaran, Tehran. Subject: Methods of Islamic Invitation. Invitation to monotheism, purification of the self, detachment the world, and confiding Allah Almighty did not meant that people should retire at home, overlook the interests of Muslims, and devote all their time to reciting prayers or supplications. As you see, the Imams, peace be upon them all, were not like this. While the Holy Prophet fulfilled his personal duties and confined it Allah, he established government and sent delegations to all parts of the world to invite people to the faith.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is the Spring of Truth. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi says, "The great Prophet of Islam sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, in one hand carried the Quran for guidance. For those who could be guided, the Quran was their means of guidance." Now, when we look at this narration, we see that Imam Khomeini is trying to highlight things over here. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam himself and Quran. So if we look at the narration, we understand that, you know, in the Quran, it refers to the guidance, you know, it guides people. There are enemies of Islam when they're trying to harm people, not just Muslim, but when they're trying to harm people, you need resistance, you need to defend the humanity. Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu alayhi. The most important thing, Rasulullah himself is the main guide that shows you how you have to use Quran, the book, the resistance, how you need to defend yourself, your community, and the humanity. So you need to take the guidance and you need to fight the enemies in the guidance of Rasulullah, or I would rather say Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And if you don't use the guidance of Rasulullah or the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, you might see that, you know, people have swords in their hands and they say La ilaha illallah. They say that we act upon the Holy Quran. It makes Daesh, Al-Qaeda and ISIS. So you need guidance from the Holy Quran and you need resistance to fight the enemies, but in the guidance of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. So yeah, let me read that the beautiful quote once again so that we can think upon. Ayatollah Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi says, "The great Prophet of Islam in one hand carried the Quran. Quran for guidance, for those who could be guided. The Quran was their means of guidance, a religion of guidance for the people." That's all for today for the Spring of Truth. And with that being said, wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
The media reported the end of the fateful meeting of the Council of Foreign Ministers of the Arab League in Cairo and their agreement with the return of Syria to this league after 12 years. Considering the fact that the Syrian president Bashar al-Assad has not given any concessions to return to the Arab League, some media outlets ironically wrote the Arab League returned to Syria. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned. The English website of Al Jazeera writes, "The Arab League, a 22-member intergovernmental organization of Arab states, on Sunday, May 7th, agreed to welcome Syria back into the fold with immediate effect after more than a decade." Media reports said the decision was made by Arab foreign ministers during a closed-door meeting in the Egyptian capital Cairo on Sunday, defying diktats issued by the U.S. and some of its allies. An Egyptian diplomat said that the return was conditional, adding that Syria's full membership of the Arab League was dependent on the return of Syrian refugees without retributions and a credible political process in the country. Earlier, the Lebanese foreign minister attached great importance to Syria's return to the Arab League, saying his country supports the process. Lebanon's online newspaper Al-Nashra reported on Sunday, May 7th, Abdullah Bou Habib made the remarks before leaving Beirut for Cairo to attend the meeting of top Arab diplomats. Bou Habib also said that Lebanon has submitted proposals to the Arab League regarding Syria's return to the Arab fold. Saudi Arabia reported that permanent representatives at the Arab League Council supported Syria's return to the pan-Arab body during a meeting on Saturday, May 6, citing an unnamed diplomat source. The Saudi daily Okan said Saturday's meeting saw overwhelming support for resumption of Syria's participation in the Arab League meetings. On Friday, May 5th, Jordanian Foreign Minister Ayman Safadi told CNN that there are enough votes among Arab League members for Syria to return to the organization. He added the Arab world is now taking the lead on resolving the Syria crisis, as there was no effective effort so far to do so. Safadi noted the return to the league will happen. Symbolically, it will be important, but that is only a very humble beginning of what will be a very long and difficult and challenging process, given the complexity of the crisis after 12 years of conflict. Since March 2011, Syria has been gripped by a campaign of militancy and destruction sponsored by the U.S. and its allies. However, in recent years, Syrian government forces backed by Russia and Iran have managed to win back control of almost all regions from terrorist groups. The Arab League suspended the membership of Syria, one of the organization's founding members, in November 2011, citing an alleged crackdown by Damascus on so-called opposition protests. Syria denounced the move as illegal and a violation of the organization's charter. In recent months, an increasing number of countries and political parties have called for the reversal of Syria's suspension from the Arab League. Meanwhile, Syria's official Sana news agency reports the Arab country's Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates has welcomed the decision by the Arab League to bring Damascus back to its fold, stressing the importance of dialogue and joint action to confront the challenges facing the Arab world. In a statement issued on Sunday, May 7th, the ministry said Syria welcomed the decision issued during the extraordinary session of the Council of the League of Arab States regarding the resumption of the Syrian delegation's participation in meetings of the League and all its affiliated organizations and agencies. It added Syria stresses in the same context the importance of dialogue and joint action to confront the challenges facing Arab countries. The ministry reaffirmed Syria's commitment to strengthening joint Arab work and cooperation, emphasizing that the next stage requires an effective and constructive approach at the bilateral and collective levels based on dialogue, mutual respect, and common interest. Earlier on Sunday, May 7th, a spokesperson for the Arab League said the decision to reinstate Syria's membership after its suspension 12 years ago will consolidate a regional push to normalize ties with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, and the country could immediately resume its participation in meetings of Arab League and all its organizations and agencies. It also called for a resolution of the crisis resulting from Syria's conflict, including the flight of refugees to neighboring states and drug smuggling across the region. Arab League Secretary General Ahmad Abulghaith said recently that President Assad can attend an Arab League summit in Saudi Arabia later this month if he wishes to. Responding to a question over whether Assad could participate in the summit, Abulghaith told a news conference in Cairo, "If he wishes, because Syria, starting from this evening, is a full member of the Arab League, and from tomorrow morning, they have the right to occupy any seat." He added, when the invitation is sent by the hosting country, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and if he wishes to participate, he will participate. Some Arab states, including the United Arab Emirates, pushed for Syria's readmission, but others, such as Qatar, remain largely opposed to full normalization without a political solution to the Syrian conflict. The Arab foreign ministers on Sunday said that Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Lebanon, Egypt, and the Arab League Secretary General would form a ministerial contract group to liaise with the Syrian government and seek step-by-step solutions to the crisis. Meanwhile, the website of Press TV wrote, Iran has welcomed Syria's return to the Arab League more than a decade after its membership was suspended by the 22-member regional organization. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Nasser Kanani said in a statement on Monday morning, May 8, settlement of disputes among Muslim countries as well as convergence and synergy among them will deliver favorable results for collective stability and peace and will pave the way for reducing foreign profit-seeking interferences in regional affairs, he added. The Islamic Republic of Iran welcomes such an approach. The Palestinian Hamas resistance movement also welcomed the announcement of Syria's return to the Arab League. Hazem Qasem, spokesperson for the Gaza's base group, said, "We welcome the decision by foreign ministers of Arab countries to reinstate Syria's membership in the Arab League." He added, "We hope all repercussions of the Syrian crisis will be addressed as soon as possible." The Hamas spokesperson also called for stronger interactions among all components of the Muslim world in order to further consolidate their position in the face of trans-regional colonial ambitions, the foremost of which is the expansionist Zionist scheme. Russia also hailed the decision to reinstate its ally Syria membership to the Arab League. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova said on Sunday, May 7th, "We think that the decision of the Council of Arab League foreign ministers has demonstrated the Arab countries' aspiration to bolster coordination of actions in the interests of settling pertinent regional and international issues and confirmed their intent to continue conducting their independent policy on the global stage based on their core interests in the future."
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a program that takes you on a journey through Africa. We cover wide-ranging current affairs in the continent and also highlight various aspects of the continent's rich history, culture, and civilization. In our program today, we are focusing on the ongoing conflict in Sudan and its regional and global implications. Amid concern that some Western powers and the Zionist regime are involved in fomenting deadly chaos in this African nation. The United Nations has also warned that the humanitarian crisis in Sudan is at a breaking point. So, what will it take to restore stability in Sudan? Our experts will be giving us their incisive analysis on the situation in this war-torn African country. So stay with us.
Sudan in turmoil. Hundreds of people have been killed and thousands injured in fighting between two rival generals in Sudan, the Army Chief General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who has for years been the de facto leader of Sudan, and paramilitary rapid support forces, the RSF, Commander Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, better known as Hemeti. The fighting broke out on the 15th of April following a disagreement that had been fomenting in recent months between the army and the RSF's integration into the armed forces, a key condition of Sudan's transition agreement with political groups.
Most countries have evacuated their citizens from Sudan, and now it is the civilians in this country who have been caught in the crossfire as the two warring sides battle for control of this country. Sudanese people are now hoping that the two generals will stop fighting for power and instead provide basic needs to the people of Sudan. And to discuss the situation in Sudan, we have contacted Sami Hamdi, the international interest editor-in-chief, and Julius Mbaluto, a political analyst. Thank you, gentlemen, for your time. So let's start off with Mr. Hamdi. Can you elaborate on the real reason behind the conflict in Sudan between the country's national army and the rapid support forces?
The crux of the problem is that the Sudanese army chief Abdel Fattah Burhan announced in February that the RSF, the rapid support forces led by Hemeti, must be merged with the army. And Hemeti understands that if the RSF is merged with the army, then Hemeti's power will essentially be diminished. It's essentially about clipping his wings. That's why Hemeti has decided to launch this attempt to topple Burhan before Burhan can clip his wings. But the reason Burhan wants to clip Hemeti's wings is much more complex. The reality is that Burhan has been holding on to power despite significant pressure from the international community to hand over power to the civilian Forces for Freedom and Change. The Forces for Freedom and Change are a group of civilian parties made up of leftist, communist, and the Ummah party that was once led by former Prime Minister Sadiq al-Mahdi. And Burhan has been refusing to hand over power to them and threatening elections if he's forced to do so. The point here is that the reason the Forces for Freedom and Change want a handover of power without elections is because they believe that they will lose in any elections, that any elections will deliver the Islamists to power. And that's why in 2021, instead of handing over power, Burhan instead toppled the government of the Forces for Freedom and Change. And then when there was international pressure on him to reverse his coup, he then threatened to hold elections. And this is what caused the panic in the international community, believing that if elections were held, then the Sudanese would choose the Islamists.
Now, let's bring in Mr. Mbaluto. As we know, Sudan has been without a functioning government since October 2021, when the military dismissed Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok's transitional government. Now, did the ouster of Hamdok lead to the current state of affairs in the country?
If we remember very well, before the first military takeover happened, it just came after. The revolution across Sudan, people protesting. They wanted to see an end to the rulership of Omar Bashir. And across the country, it was people protesting just across the country. So the military came to hijack the revolution, definitely. They just came to hijack the revolution.
Kenya's president, William Ruto, has said that the situation in Sudan is evolving into a threat to regional and international peace and security. Ruto also urged both sides to extend cooperation to a regional body known as the Intergovernmental Authority on Development that is trying to mediate.
A pattern of systematic violation of established norms and principles of international humanitarian law is clearly emerging, and this situation is evolving into a threat to regional and international peace and security.
Any further escalation of the conflict in Sudan will affect the wider eastern and northern African region and indeed the rest of the world.
In terms of the regional impact, war is not such a great thing because immediately it causes displacement of communities. It causes political instability because now all these people fleeing from war, they are going to countries which are neighboring, but also those countries are also experiencing their own challenges. And therefore, it just becomes even harder for all these countries surrounding.
The Sudanese people have been in the streets to demand civilian rule and to oppose a normalization deal between the military rulers and the Israeli regime. The generals had promised a return to civilian rule, but they have apparently betrayed the people by engaging in a deadly conflict. Greed, self-enrichment, and foreign meddling are seen as reasons these generals betrayed the aspirations of the people of Sudan.
I think that the betrayal comes from an international community and civilian leftist parties that agreed to enter into a deal with the army to prevent elections and prevent the Sudanese from choosing their leaders. When Omar al-Bashir was toppled, there was an opportunity to go to elections and let the Sudanese choose leaders with a mandate in order to govern the transition period. The reason they didn't go to elections was because Washington, Abu Dhabi, and the civilian leftist parties, they believed that if they went to elections, then it would be the same result as in Tunisia when the Islamist won, the same result as in Libya when the Islamist won, the same result in Egypt when the Islamist won, the same result in these other places where the Islamists were at the forefront and the beneficiaries. So they collectively came together to say, we don't want the Sudanese to vote. In other words, the betrayal began from the very beginning of the transition period. The whole transition period is built on the premise of denying the Sudanese any right to choose their leaders because they will not choose correctly. And this is the betrayal. It's not that the generals have betrayed the Sudanese people. It's that the international community that keeps talking about democracy for Sudan betrayed the Sudanese and refused to give them democracy because they didn't believe that they would make a choice that they prefer.
The conflict in Sudan has ignited concerns of an outbreak of civil war in the fragile western region of Darfur. The militia group known as the Rapid Support Forces battling the Sudanese army is led by Mohamed Degallo from the Mahariye clan of Darfur's Rizai Gach tribe. Now, there is real fear that the battles between Sudan's tribal military leaders could reawaken war in the vast and largely desert region of Darfur, already scarred by a two-decades-old conflict. Now, what's your take on this?
I think there is great fears now that the war might spread to Darfur. It's important to remember that the reason Darfur calmed down is because Omar al-Bashir, in his agreement with the Darfurians, he included them in the government. He pushed for further investment in Darfur. He promoted them, Minni al-Minnawi and Jibril Ibrahim and other of these Darfurian leaders. He succeeded in winning over them and essentially forming this sort of power-sharing arrangement or including them within the government in a way that satisfied them. What's important to highlight as well is that the Darfurians have opposed the Forces for Freedom and Change and tended to side with Burhan. In 2021, when the army chief toppled the civilian government, one of the reasons he was able to do so was because the Darfurians, who have historically been backed internationally in their fight against the Sudanese state, the Darfurians themselves were very loudly complaining that there was a preference for leftist parties that could never win any elections. So Jibril Ibrahim and Minni al-Minnawi were saying, this is an unfair transition process that is disproportionately benefiting those who don't have much popular weight in the amongst the Sudanese electorate. I think that now what we're seeing is that Hemeti believes that he is able to, if he loses this fight against the Sudanese army, then he will find some base that he can operate from Darfur.
Well, thank you for that, Mr. Hamdi. Let's now take a short break before we continue our talk on the turmoil currently being experienced in Sudan.
Sudan in turmoil.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back to Africa Today. This week we are discussing the political turmoil in Sudan amid concern over foreign meddling in the country. Now, the current conflict in Sudan is seen by analysts as part of a long-term plan by imperialist powers to balkanize Sudan. Now, the strategic objective of this plan is to ensure that the Israeli regime's superiority through the balkanization of Western Asia and Arab states into smaller and weaker states. It is in this context that the usurper Israeli regime has been deeply involved in fomenting chaos in Sudan.
Lest we forget, Sudan was the largest country by area in Africa and the Arab League until the secession of South Sudan in 2011. This secession was backed by the U.S.-led Western powers and the Israeli regime. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov recently called on Sudan's warring parties to remember how the Sudanese state evolved. During a news conference at the United Nations, Lavrov blamed the U.S. for dividing the country into a northern state and a southern state. Let's take a listen.
Let us recall the developments with Sudanese statehood, first in the singular and then Sudan and South Sudan. And this was all transpiring before our very eyes when our U.S. colleagues made one of their foreign policy priorities the division of Sudan into two parts. They turned to us for the then President Omar al-Bashir for us to persuade Mr. Bashir to reach an agreement for the conduct of free elections on voluntary separation and division, and we, frankly speaking, thought that the Sudanese people, the peoples, should make that decision. And ultimately, the division took place. It was separated into two parts. A South Sudan was created, and the Americans, as the initiators of this divorce, so to speak, should have done everything possible to help these new two states coexist, to develop their economies, to provide for the welfare of their citizens, but the Americans didn't like something. I won't delve into the details, but they imposed sanctions both against the leadership of Sudan and against the leadership of South Sudan.
Now, Mr. Hamdi, Western powers and the Israeli regime backed South Sudan during the war that eventually led to the secession of this country. Now, there is concern that continued clashes between the warring sides in Sudan are actually part of a long-term plan by Western powers and the Zionist regime to further balkanize this third largest African country. Do you agree with this viewpoint?
When we're looking at what's happening in Sudan, the Americans have two scenarios. One is that Sudan removes Islam from the constitution, it becomes a secular state, the Islamists are no longer in power, and instead they have these leftist and powers that are ruling Sudan and they are supported by the international community. If the Sudanese army rejects that, as Burhan is doing at this moment in time, then they will support other separatist movements, whether it's in Darfur or the like, essentially splitting